Massachusetts General Government Committee. We're just thrilled to be here in your community, and we're really thrilled to be in this spectacular facility. I don't think I've ever seen a more beautiful library, and we're very pleased to be here. My name is Vicki Berger. I'm a representative from Salem, the Salem area, and I'm the chair of this committee. Next to me is Kara Fisher, who is our committee administrator and does all for us. And over there is Katie Howard, and she does the technical details that keep us all going. I presume there's a couple of you who are pretty familiar with legislative process and what happens here. For those that, of you who haven't actually seen a legislative hearing, that's part of the reason that we're here, and I'll be banging the gavel occasionally, and you go, oh, that's what they do, and that's what we do. I am going to, we're kind of here guests of folks that you know, Representative Esquivel from Medford, Buckley, Representative Richardson, but what I'd really like to do for all of everyone's sake is just go down the line and have each of us introduce, the members introduce themselves and where their districts are. So get it.
Dennis Richardson, District 4, from Central Point, actually Northwest Medford, all the way across the valley to Grants Pass.
I'm Representative Larry Galizio, and that is the Tigard area, unincorporated Washington County.
I'm Peter Buckley, Representative District 5, Ashland, Talent, Phoenix, Jacksonville, and two precincts in Medford. I happily chair the city of Representative Esquivel.
And I'm Representative Esquivel, and I have, I believe, all my constituencies within the city limits of Medford except 17 voters. So I'm kind of a rural guy.
Kevin Cameron, represented from District 19, which is just a little bit of the Salem city limits, and then Almsville, Turner area, Marion County, rural area. It's good to be here.
So that's who we are. For those of you who have not noted, our staff would like you to note there are sign-up sheets over there and various other bits of material that we'll refer to as we go by. We actually have on our agenda specific hearings of bills. And one of them, I'm afraid, the first one on the agenda,
you can just fold it out.
Okay. We don't have anyone. The first one on the agenda, by the way, is House Bill 2157, which is a series of issues around fingerprinting that this committee has been hearing in the building. We had hoped to have some other information and other testimony when we got down here. It didn't happen in time, so unless there's someone who signed up specifically who wants to talk about fingerprinting in that particular bill, it probably will not hear that one. The next one, however, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2911. And as the usual protocol when a bill is introduced, that the introducer, who is a member of the body, gets to speak on it first and tell us about it. But when you're in Medford and you have an ex-representative in the room, you give them the protocol even though they don't have the title anymore. So I'm going to ask Rob Patridge to come up and introduce this piece of legislation, despite the fact that he doesn't have his title anymore. And with him is Gerald Burns, so please come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the courtesy and members of the committee. I'm glad and welcome to Medford. I'm happy to see Sal here, and Sal's actually the one who introduced this bill on behalf of myself, because it was a remaining constituent issue that was outstanding prior to the end of my legislative service. Sal took the bull by the horns, or Representative Esquivel. I got to get used to Representative Esquivel took the bill by the horns in this case and introduced House Bill 2911. Rather than belabor the issue with a uncertified smart person about the technical pieces of this particular legislation, really the brains and person behind this bill, and I think you have a revenue statement in relation to this, is Gerald Burns. Mr. Burns is a CPA. He's on various national CPA committees. He's a very distinguished accountant here in our community, and he's someone who performs a lot of these local and municipal audits that would be affected by this particular piece of legislation. It was a good piece of, I think it's a good piece of good government legislation, and that's why Jerry asked me to bring it forward. He tries to make things run efficiently for governments, just like we all do in the legislature. And with that said, Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, welcome to Medford. I'm glad to see many old faces that I know and new faces. You have many great people in the audience who have come out for your hearing tonight, who are all great Medford and Southern Oregon people, to hear what you all have to say and watch you perform. So I will, at this point in time, Madam Chair, with your indulgence, turn over to Mr. Jerry Burns, who's a CPA, who's the brains behind this particular piece of legislation.
Very much, Rob. Jerry, I ask that you give us your name for the record, and welcome, and we appreciate you coming and talking about this bill.
Thank you. My name, Madam Chairman, is Gerald W. Burns, CPA. I've been practicing in Oregon and Medford here since 1976, into 75. I served on the Board of Accountancy for some 9 years, and as Rob said, I also served on the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy for another 9 years, which I just finished up about a year or so ago. And I'm currently serving on the Auditing Standards Board, which is a national body that creates audit standards for non-publicly held companies. My practice in Oregon since 1975 has included a large number of local governments. And local governments, as you may be familiar, are required to submit financial reports on an annual basis. And depending on the size, indicates whether or not they have an audit, whether they have a review, whether they have a statement in lieu of, meaning that it doesn't actually get an auditor's report on it nor an accountant's report. And those three levels of services, in an audit, of course, that's the highest level of assurance you're going to get from an auditor or municipal auditor. A review is going to be something less than high level, but still assurance. But yet, the third approach that has been provided for much, much smaller governments has been to submit a non-attested to or assured on financial report. And it's because these organizations are considered to be extremely small, and currently they're exempt from audit or review because the combination of their revenues and expenditures don't exceed $150,000, and they have a bond on their on who's ever handling the money. Often these organizations have no paid staff, they're only volunteers. They do everything themselves. And they range from cemetery districts to water districts to fire districts to road districts to even a small town could probably fall into this category, though I don't know of any. And the case that came to my attention that caused me to write this letter to Rob was the cemetery district over in Brookings. This little operation's been there for a long, long time. They have three volunteers who run this cemetery, and they arrange for the burials, they cut the grass, they prune the flowers, they do a whole lot at the Ward Memorial Cemetery, as well as take care of three other pioneer cemeteries. It came to pass that they wanted to have some niches, a wall built on a hillside, and in the niches, of course, are going to go cremation remains. And so they set about doing that, and they expended more in that formula because of building the wall and everything. They went over the 150 up to about 170 at the most, which required them to go from not having an audit, not having a review, just maintaining their books and their budget and doing the normal thing. And that additional cost to them was close to $5,000. Between the money that it took them to get prepared for it, because I assist them quite a bit, to arrange for the independent auditing firm to come and do the review and to get it all done. And now we're faced with it for a second year. And this organization generates from taxes about $40,000. It generates from people going into the ground about another $40,000. It's just not a big deal. But yet when you add these numbers together, they exceed the threshold. So in talking to Phil Hopkins at the Division of Audits, I found that this was not uncommon in these little small operations, and he said that the most recurring example are fire districts when they buy a new fire truck. That they'll go out and get a fire truck on a lease purchase agreement or something, and suddenly, bingo, they go from not having to pay anything for professional auditor accounting services to having to pay $5,000 or more to get this whole thing done to comply with this requirement. So I submitted it. This suggestion, it's been very well reflected in the bill. It raises the thresholds by $100,000, which should be sufficient to cover a lot of people. It also provides in there for a specific exemption. If it's a non-recurring thing, like the purchase of a fire truck or the building of a niche wall or whatever that might be. I think that the bill fairly reflects my suggestions. The only suggestion that I did have, I didn't have the specific exemption in it where you had to request the Division of Audits to do it, but I was referring to a provision in the IRS code that oftentimes when you bump up against a threshold, it's based on an average of 3 years, so that I was asking for a couple of years grace to determine whether or not it was a permanent change in their revenues or expenditures. But that's reflected in the request for an exemption, because it provides you can have an exemption 2 years in a row, but in the third year, it's kind of like the third year you're out. If it happens again, you're filing. So I think the bill fairly reflects my suggestion in the matter. I was rather impressed to look at this chart to see how many organizations or local governments will be positively affected, and you can see, for instance, the third category, the in lieu category, will grow by some 5%. This little chart looks like this, and that's significant, because if you're looking at $3,000 or $4,000 to do that, even that mid level report before you move to an audit, that's going to cost you almost twice that much just at the entry level to get an audit. There is quite a bit of savings embedded in this bill that will come to benefit the smaller governments in Oregon. So I'm pleased to see that it was written up as HB 2911, and I certainly support it and encourage you to do so as well. Answer any questions?
Yeah, thank you. Before we have questions, Kara, would you go through kind of the mechanics of the bill for us briefly, and the report that he referenced, which copies of and the bill are over in the bag? I apologize to you.
Oh, no, that's fine, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I think that your witnesses have really given you a very good overview of the bill. I should give you a little more background that I don't think we spoke to the actual numbers as much, did you, today? That what this bill would do is change from 150,000 annual receipts and expenses for small governments to 250,000, and it changed, and those people then would qualify for the in lieu process. And in lieu, the organization creates its own financial statement, and it is covered by the person who does their takes in the receipts and writes the checks and that type of thing. The organization is required to carry a fidelity bond on that individual. So there are some checks on that. And the Secretary of State's office, once they've been told that this organization is filing in lieu, they automatically each year send them the filing papers for that. The review process, which as you were just told, is a shorter version of a formal audit. It changes those numbers from they are now in statute at 150,000 to 500,000, changes that to 250,000 to 600,000. And what I copied into your materials today are the existing Oregon revised statutes that are behind how this process works now through the Audits Division. And also the chart that the witness referenced was created actually just yesterday by the Secretary of State's Audit Division. So it's a very timely sheet, and there are extra copies in the back of the room if the audience is interested in looking at that. It clearly shows you on the second page the list, the numbers of the various types of service districts. Even there are some small cities that are impacted by the in lieu or the review process, and seeing the change in numbers that would be impacted if you were to
to move this legislation, I think, is quite interesting. The other thing I did want to share with you is a similar bill. House Bill 2382 is presently assigned to the House Audits Committee. They have had one public hearing on the bill. It has very similar issues, but I think a little more lenient, but I've heard from my colleague on that committee that that committee is looking at a lot of amendments to the bill, and at some point we may need to look at the two side by side to see if there's yet another piece of legislation we want to come from this. But I did want you to be aware of House Bill 2382, which is very, very similar, but not assigned to the General Government Committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? And Representative Esquivel, you need to get a hand in this.
Actually, I did. I was the one that had this drafted on behalf of my fellow former Representative Patridge and Mr. Burns, CPA. And we pretty much outlined everything is in this bill. It's a pretty simplistic bill, and it's just moving the bar a little bit to help smaller organizations. We don't usually, when we think of government, we don't usually think of the cemetery or the water districts or the fire districts or things that we think of the municipalities, the county, and the state, whereas this gets down into the smaller part of government and helps them actually to be more fiscally responsible.
Thank you.
Mr. Burns, or
yes.
Rob, maybe you know the answer. This is a great statistic sheet that I guess was referred to us just from yesterday from the Secretary of State's Audit Division. Do we know approximately with these numbers how much this would save these cities, these organizations, based on your estimates of what they would spend if we didn't pass this?
Well, there's about 100. The number that could fall into the in lieu category would be almost 100. And I would say that at a minimum, you're talking about $4,000 a piece. And in the review area, where you see 60 going up, you could see 60 organizations dropping from $8,000 to $10,000 or $11,000 down to 4 or 5 or 6. So there's a considerable financial impact in here, positive for these organizations. And the fact that they don't happen to have a review or an audit anymore doesn't mean that they're completely bare out there, because they still have their budget committee, they still have the public input on that budget. They still have to keep the records because they got to prepare the financial statement at the end of the year, and they have to have a bond that covers all the money that they're spending in that category. And as I said, something certainly can go wrong, but I think there's really adequate coverage and protection between the in lieu reports and the bond and the size of the budgets and the money that's being spent. And these people often have to use the county treasurer as their bank. For instance, that's the case of a cemetery district. They have to keep their money up there. They have to deposit all their money up at the county treasurer, and they can only draw down enough money to pay out of the check register. So there are safeguards there.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think there's another thing. Mr. Burns has done this for many, many years, and I think it's important that, you know, as Jerry and I talked about this, there really hasn't been a lot of problems with these small districts to any case. Mm-hmm. I think based upon Jerry and my prior conversations about funny things with accounting or other things, and there are adequate safeguards here. It's always interesting as somebody who's a lawyer and a professional or accountants coming forward that they're taking money out of really their colleagues' pockets and other people's pockets to save money on these municipal audits and other things where they make money, because it's really the right thing to do to make the system work.
And if they fail to submit the report and they don't request an extension of time to submit it, then they're going to fall into the I don't want to call it a trap, but they fall into the situation where they're going to have to step up and do the higher level report, which is a little more intrusive about what they were doing and why was it that they didn't file the appropriate report.
That's statutory. Is there in the statute, does anybody know what the consequences of failure to report currently?
It's in statute, and the Secretary of State's audit division watches that very closely. You do know if the Secretary of State's office hasn't heard from you within 90 days of the close of either your calendar or fiscal year, depending on which you use, they start with the nasty letters, that's watched very closely. So it is in statute. It's spelled out what the penalties are and what the procedures are, and that's for extension.
Let me point out another good benefit to these folks is that there was passed at the Governmental Accounting Standards Board level. I don't know how familiar you are with governmental financial reporting, but a standard called GASB 34. GASB 34 totally changed the financial reporting model of government from a model that had been used for some 100 years. And in its particular iteration for like 25 years. And they changed the way governments report. And that has had a major impact on the cost of even getting these reports done now, the cost of conversion. And it was so major that the phase-in period was 3 years. The states and the largest cities who had budgets in excess of $100 million did them first. The next group were between 10 million and 100 million, and they did them next. And then the last group, the largest throughout the country, phase three, were doing them in the 2003-04 year. Most of those people haven't filed their reports this year because of this major turnover. The state's reports, forms that they use, are much, much simpler. They don't follow that GASB 34 format, which is required under Oregon law that everybody who files a review or an audit has to file this much, much more technically involved report. So that, and that's a report at the level of these people in lieu. They don't understand that report, even when they get it and having spent the money, and it goes to the Secretary of State, and they drop it in the file and check it off and say they've got it on the phone. So this is a much better approach. This is what I do for a living. I'm telling you that I shouldn't.
Further questions from the panel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Springs, I echo what Patrick said, if you're willing to incur the wrath of your colleagues and take away business from them, I salute you for that. Do I understand this correctly, too, with the Secretary of State's office? This would perhaps lessen their workload a bit to have a simpler system in place.
I think it would, because people will get their reports in on time. They won't have to track them down. And when they do the reviews, they're not as intensive of their time, because periodically representatives from the audits division go out and review these reports. They're simpler reports. They don't need to do a lot.
Very good. Nice to meet you.
Yes, and I didn't do my homework to find out when was the last time this was adjusted, because I think this has been on the books for quite some time, and of course what we're doing is we're kind of bring this up to date here a little bit. Because this 150 to 500,000, I don't know when it was initiated, but it's been quite some time ago.
It's been the early 90s.
Okay, so it's been 10, 15 years.
Easy.
At least.
Yes. Oh, yes. It hasn't been updated for a while. And even then, it was updated. So it's a good move.
Questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Bob. Nice to see you. Thanks for bringing this forward to our attention. I don't have anyone else signed up, but if anyone in the audience would like to speak on this particular issue, now would be a good time before I bang this gavel one more time. We have been in a public hearing, and the notice says public hearing and possible work session. Possible work session is when we vote, and as the administrator indicated, there are complications with another similar bill, so we will not be voting on this today. And I am therefore going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2911. Seeing no further testimony. What we thought we'd like to do down here tonight is kind of give you a look at the kinds of things this committee has been dealing with. There you are. This committee, of general government, as you can see, deals with a lot of issues regarding government, and we have had a particular focus this session on regulatory streamlining with regard to making business regulations work better for the state, I am sure that you can understand why this would be important. And we have an Office of Regulatory Streamlining. I don't know why that would surprise anyone. And its director is here. His name is Pat Allen, and I'd ask Pat to come forward and talk to us and give you a glimpse of the kinds of things that we're working on. And then after Pat speaks on this issue, I would welcome testimony from any of you, your pet peeve about business regulatory streamlining. We can't solve all problems. And we'll talk a little bit about what Pat could do to help. And there's also a sign-up sheets out here for if you don't want to talk and you've got a pet peeve and would like us to know about it, you can write it down and send it to us. And we actually are, well, we would be happy to accept testimony on just about any subject that you want to tell us about. Thank you, Pat.
Great. Chair Berger, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen, and I manage the state's Office of Regulatory Streamlining. I'm very pleased to be with you tonight in Medford to update you on what the office and what state agencies have been doing in terms of how we're working to streamline business regulations. I'll also be able to provide you a bit of a legislative update on a number of bills that are in process right now, and then talk about some upcoming work. Agency, the office was created by the governor 2 years ago, and the focus is, as the chair says, to look at business regulations and figure out ways that agencies can make them simpler, faster, cheaper, easier to understand, easier to comply with, while still maintaining protections that Oregonians expect for consumers, workers, public health, safety, and the environment. In other words, we're not about lowering standards. We're about how do we achieve those same standards in ways that are more streamlined. The office's role is to work with agencies to figure out, to help them identify ways that they can work on their regulations. We often convene or lead projects, and I'll talk about some of those. Over the past 2 years, agencies have done about 250 different projects, either that they have completed or that are in process now, that do streamlining in one fashion or another. These range from small changes, kind of nibbling at the edges of some issues, to some fairly large-scale projects. Some examples I can share with you. We did a focus on agencies working on paperwork reduction. We've got a handful of agency projects we identified actually several months ago, about 9 projects that between them save businesses, Oregon businesses, over 250,000 sheets of paper a year. And it ranges everywhere from taking the form that an employer has to fill out when a worker is injured and changing it from a 5-page form to a 3-page form, helping trucking companies do all of their business with the state, have the ability to do it online. So the information is still collected, but there's not reams and reams of paperwork necessarily to fill out. And that's everything from paying their taxes to doing any kind of registration, licensing. Until this trucking online project came online, trucking companies had to go get in line at DMV just like individuals, but with lots more paper to have to do if they were dealing with large numbers of truck transactions. Some other projects that we're involved in right now, my office has convened a working group of about 8 state agencies that are involved in water-related permitting. This is wetlands remove and fill and those kinds of permits, to pull some people together and get them around a table and figure out what can we do to try to make that process ensure that it protects the environmental values that the law says we need to protect, but figure out a way that businesses can get through that process quicker in a more straightforward fashion and have a better understanding up front of what is it they're going to need to do to be able to do a project that involves some kind of wetland remove and fill. We're working on a pilot project right now with retailers, small retailers, convenience stores. I should stop a minute. You talked about a suggestion form. Suggestions are the lifeblood of what we do. We can sit in Salem and think all day long about what would be a good way to streamline regulations, but real examples from real people about, you know, how their business is impacted are just solid gold. This project involving convenience stores came from a referral from a legislator who had a person in his district running a convenience store who was able to bend my ear for about an hour saying, oh, you know all the things I have to deal with. Well, I learned about all the things he had to deal with, and it's about a dozen different regulatory agencies for convenience stores. Everything that's being regulated makes sense. It's the Department of Agriculture for food safety if you've got a deli counter. It's DEQ if you have underground storage tanks to make sure they're properly operated and so on.
Well, we pulled all 12 of those agencies together and said, there's an issue here, because even though everybody's doing something that makes sense, it's a lot of impact on the business. It could mean a regulator once a month in their business looking at one thing or another. So what kinds of things could we think about doing that would lighten that load? We came up with a small piece of that puzzle in their case, which is three agencies, Agriculture, OLCC, and DEQ, actually do some kind of an annual licensing transaction with convenience stores. And so we have those three agencies working right now on a pilot project of, instead of sending separate paperwork three times a year out to the business and having the person fill out the form, which contains lots of the same information, three times a year and send in three checks, can we have one transaction where we send out the paperwork once and it's less paperwork altogether, and they do that once and it's out of their hair for a period of time.
Chair, Mr. Allen, I'm wondering if there's any move toward eliminating the paperwork completely and allowing businesses to just do all of that on the Internet.
Yeah, excellent question, Mr. Chair Berger, Representative Richardson. Yes, online transactions are a piece of what we're trying to look at generally. There are the Department of Consumer and Business Services has effectively acquired a state enterprise-wide license for online licensing software that they're beginning to implement with the licenses that agency does in banking and finance and building codes. And then they're working with other agencies to make what they learn from that system and the availability of the software widely available. The pilot project on convenience stores is a long way from being able to do that particular thing, just because the agencies involved have a huge range of technological capability. OLCC in particular, and in fact they have a budget request in this session to improve their computer capability just to deal with that.
Senator Jackie Lynn has the quarter every time.
I'm sorry, I said OLCC.
And I'm not going to go there, but you've used OLCC twice and DEQ once, so let's go back.
I apologize. Oregon Liquor Control Commission and Department of Environmental Quality.
Thank you.
So online licensing is not something for that particular project on the horizon, but it is something that's being looked at by a lot of agencies. Jumping ahead a little bit, talking about legislation, there's a bill that, in fact, is now ready for the governor's signature that has to do with a collection of notarization requirements on licensing forms that we figured out we don't really need, and by getting rid of the notarization requirements, those licenses could be done online now, and there are a couple of agencies there that are actively looking at that. In fact, let me go ahead and transition over to legislation. As you know, the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, together with a number of agencies, submitted a package of nearly three dozen bills that do streamlining in one fashion or another. I'm happy to be able to tell you that five of those bills are now ready for the governor's signature. They're amongst the first bills to come out of the process, and four of them originated with this committee. And so I'm very pleased to have had your help in getting an early start and getting those bills moving through. The bills are a lot like the projects. There aren't necessarily big, huge stories with them. They make small changes, but they're important changes. I can tell you that I just talked about the notarization requirement. There's a bill, House Bill 2093, that has to do with OSHA notices, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. These were notices that were sent to businesses because they met some kind of a statistical definition of more likely than average of having a workplace injury to say you might get inspected. Thousands of these notices would go out, but almost always to businesses that, in fact, weren't any more likely to get inspected. And it was stuff that it was a notice that would get a business person would get and get concerned about, and there'd be lots of phone calls back and forth. And we were able to figure out that we just don't need to send those. And so that bill is now ready for signature. There's a bill that's not ready for signature yet, but getting close, which has to do with all the various definitions of what's an independent contractor. Ranges from issues at the Employment Department, at Revenue, and there's a bill to try to make those definitions much more similar. So you, a business person or an employee, has a good idea of, are they an employee or are they an independent contractor? Let me just talk then about very briefly about a couple of things, wrap up with a couple of things that we're planning on doing as the next biennium starts. I talked about combined licensing. There is a bill this session to allow us to do lots more pilot projects on combined licensing. We think this is a gold mine of an area for us to begin to dig into of businesses that get touches from lots of regulators, and are there ways that we can process those things together so that you don't get touched as often and you can get rid of that paperwork. And so we'll be working on expanding that project. We're beginning to have conversations with local government now about how to begin to transition from focusing solely on state agency regulations to how state and local regulations work with each other. And we're actually beginning to look for volunteer local communities that want to do some pilot projects that that look at how those regulatory processes work together and how we can improve them. Things like more comprehensive pre-application conferences if you're going to do a development project, or different ways that state licensing impacts local processes and those kinds of things. We're beginning a project having to do with water reuse in a year where there's a pretty strong consensus that we're going to have significant water problems. The governor has just issued an executive order dealing with the drought, and among the issues that he identified there was the need to look at all the different regulations that have to do with how we can reuse water. This is things like domestic water that's suitable not for drinking but really suitable for irrigation or use on parks, golf courses, and those kinds of things. There's a huge set of regulations around that conflict with each other, make that difficult to do, so we'll be working on that. Finally, we'll be doing a second version of our business climate survey. We started the process asking businesses, how are we doing? How is our regulatory system? How are the agencies you deal with in terms of the clarity of their regulations, the responsiveness, the timeliness, the cost, and those kinds of things? And we've got a good benchmark start. In the next year or so, we'll be ready to go back and check again and ask, have things changed? Have things gotten any better in terms of your dealings with the state government? So that's a very quick overview of some of what we're doing in regulatory streamlining, and I'm really interested to go sit back out there and hear ideas or suggestions or concerns your constituents have and see if there are ways that we can help work on them. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
One quick question, Pat. How talk about people making suggestions. In addition to business owners who deal with needs to make a suggestion, how can just a member of the general public make a suggestion on how to make state government work better?
There's about 16 forms you fill out.
16 different agencies.
I'm asking this.
Representative Buckley, if it's suggestions about how to improve state government generally, I think that suggestions like that to you as individual legislators to this committee would be very appropriate. My focus really is on business regulations. I think again, we're happy to work with the committee if people want to contact their legislators or the committee about suggestions. There are forms available. I'll be here and can provide my card to people. We also have a website, streamline.oregon.gov. Which, among other things, provides a lot of updates on some of the information I've talked about tonight, but also has a suggestion form, and those get to me directly. And so we're interested in trying to gather information any way we can. Thank you.
Sorry, could you hear me? Katie's giving me the look on the other end. Any further questions? Pat, you just mentioned a website.
Mm-hmm.
Is it linked to, it's in the State of Oregon web. A comment for folks that the State of Oregon maintains a pretty extensive web system, and if you're looking for anything concerning legislative or agency matters, don't hesitate to delve in there, and you'll find that under...
Yeah, the main state website is www.oregon.gov. And that's the umbrella for all state agencies. You'll find what we do in streamlining more directly at streamline.oregon.gov. No www, but
keywords
all out there.
And I will tell you that this particular committee has done a lot in this arena. It's been sort of a special focus of this committee's session. Pat, before you get out of the chair, talk a little bit about how Oregon is doing, in your opinion, compared to other states, and particularly with regard to putting together an agency such as yours.
Chair Berger, we've taken an approach in Oregon, I think, that is maybe somewhat different than what other states that we have looked at have done. Probably the best known regulatory streamlining effort is the state of New York's. which has now been in existence for about 10 years and has a staff of about 50 people.
Yes.
It's become a department to do streamlining. The governor's intent in our effort was for this to be a very lean process. I am the Office of Regulatory Streamlining.
In case anybody wondered.
I have a person on loan from another agency who graciously helps me with projects, but it's a very lean operation. And the expectation is that this is not a permanent part of government. We expect to do this for a period of time, probably 2 to 4 years, maybe a little bit longer. And at that point, you know, either we've done great work and we've changed the way agencies look at regulations and we've made some changes and we as the office can go away, or it's not working as an approach and we should stop. But in either case, it's not something that permanently exists.
You brought the whole agency down with
projects. That sure is our fault. Any other questions of Pat? Pat, if you'd sit in the back and listen up.
All right. Thank you very much.
We really appreciate you coming down and telling folks about your agency. At this time, yeah, Representative.
I would like to take some time here to acknowledge we have in our midst the Vice President of the Medford City Council, and that's Skip and I. Hi, Skip. How you doing?
Nice to see you. Nice to have you here. As I referenced, there's a form, a government form you can fill out or take with you. But we'd really like to hear from you. And Jerry's graciously decided he wants to speak again and has already signed up. So I'll bring you up, Jerry, and to talk again. But we are here to hear from you for the rest of the evening on this or other subjects of interest that you would like to talk to us about. If we think it's something that we can help with, we can have Pat delve into regulatory streamlining with regards to business. On other issues, we'll either get back to you with ideas or direction, specific questions, or whatever. We're here to listen to you for the rest of the evening. And welcome, Jerry. Thank you. Again, you'll have to state your name.
Thank you. My name is Gerald W. Burns. I'm a CPA here in Medford, where I live and work and whatever. And the topic I'd like to mention to you tonight is embodied in HB 2195. It is an amendment to the ORS 673, which is the, I guess, the enabling statute that allows the Board of Accountancy to do what it does. And as I mentioned previously, I was a member of the Board of Accountancy for some 9 years and also at the national level, so I'm quite familiar with what the Board of Accountancy does. Well, the Board has proposed that they be granted a certain authority that's referred to as cease and desist. And I know Representative Richardson has taken an interest in this bill, and I know that it's been amended within the last few weeks to, I think the key part of it was that the order, if there was a cease and desist order to be issued, it would not be effective for some 30 days. And during which time facts and circumstances could be, I guess, more ferreted out and people come to a conclusion. But the reason that such an authority, I think, is important to the Board of Accountancy is not that there's a whole lot of issues or cases that come before them where such an authority or power is necessary to reach a satisfactory resolution. It's really in very few cases, but they're very intractable cases. And there are situations where someone may have been licensed by the Board of Accountancy at some time in the past, and that they have failed to maintain their continuing education, they've failed to maintain a renewal of their license, they've failed to do everything that you're supposed to do to be licensed as a certified public accountant in the state of Oregon. But they operate in a business that has a sign out front that says they're a CPA, or they may never have had a license and say they're a CPA. And the purpose of this authority in those particular cases would be to stop that from occurring, rather than just sending letters to these folks telling them not to do it again. That it has been felt by the current Board of Accountancy that it was that such an authority should be necessary, and I believe that it probably would help them operate in the more effectively in the future should they have that power, because I know that there were situations during the time that I served on the board where such an authority would have been helpful. But again, it's not for the everyday run-of-the-mill thing. It is for something that it's very very infrequent, but those people can cause considerable harm to anyone that they practice on or provide services to under the cover or color of being a licensed CPA in the state, and yet they're really not. So that's what it's all about, in my book.
Jerry, I'm going to show you government responsibility at its most amazing level. That bill was heard in the House Revenue Committee, and I believe it passed out of the House 2 days ago.
Good for them.
Don't you think it was 2 days ago?
Was it a couple days ago?
Was it today or yesterday?
It might have been today.
Was it today? Oh, well.
Sure.
My panic was you were going to stand up and say, I hate it. Make it go. Yeah.
Actually, I took a look at this bill because I became aware of it, and I wanted to go through it and was concerned that an agency would have that kind of judicial power to not only be regulating the accountants but also have the ability to say that you must cease and desist certain activities, and to if you don't there's going to be a $5,000 fine. And so I said, I just feel a little uncomfortable with this, and so what I really want is to make sure that there's no question that if there's resistance on the other side that there would be an appeal process, that there could be a hearing on that, so that somebody that's getting this kind of a letter with a threat of a fine would have a clear understanding that he could appeal that. And so we just kind of made an agreement on that. There was an amendment to the original bill, and now it is on its way to the Senate.
And I spoke to the administrator shortly after she spoke with you, I believe.
Which, Madam Chair, I also contacted some CPAs, and I said, tell me about the board. I want to know, can they be trusted? Is there a history of overreaching or anything like that? And they said, absolutely not. They said, this board is very professional, and there's never been a history of any problems at all. The board watches out for the industry and for the people. So that helped.
So, if that isn't responsive, I don't know what is. This bill actually was heard by the Revenue Committee very early in the session, and then there were some issues that needed to be worked out, as referenced by Representative Richardson, and it was today. Very recently.
300 miles ago.
300.
One, I'm happy to hear it was passed out, and secondly, I was happy to hear the report that Representative Richardson learned about the Board of Accounts.
Yeah.
So I'll pass that on.
Yes,
to
Representative.
And Mr. Burns, this is nothing, and Representative Richardson, this is nothing new, because the real estate agency has had that ability for quite some time to where they can assess fines. I believe the state is practicing real estate without the benefit of a license. And you get a gift certificate from the state for doing so, and that's a cease and desist order. So there's several entities that do this, and I believe they're working on one for architects.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes.
I was told that this is done by lots of agencies, and I said, so? That doesn't mean it's good, so I want to take a close look at it. But it is being done by other agencies, and there's no indication that that power is being abused.
Madam Chair, it was also, I'm on the Revenue Committee, and we heard this, and it was very helpful. The chair of the Revenue Committee, Tom Butler, was a CPA for, I don't know, 3 decades, perhaps. And so, okay. But I don't want to go on record saying longer than that. So those that testified were very impressive, so it had a pretty good bedding.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'll say that Representative Butler has been a CPA for at least 10 years.
Well, thank you for the time and the information.
And thank you. And contact your senator, because the bill now goes to the Senate, and from there. And an email doesn't hurt a thing to remind your elected officials of what your issues are.
Thanks, ma'am.
Thank you very much. We have more sign-up sheets. We have more people who signed up. If you want to speak to us, please come over. You can sign up at any time. I'd like to ask Ann Billiter, am I close? Who's with the library? Who's our hostess today?
Thank you, Chair Berger and members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be here. I'm Ann Billiter. I'm a resident of Medford. I'm the Children's, Young Adult, and South Region Manager for the Jackson County Library System, which has 15 branches here in Jackson County. And as you said, this is the headquarters library. And yes, we are justly very proud of it and of our other new branches. I came to talk to you briefly about House Bill 2916, which would repeal the portion of the Ready to Read grants that requires a maintenance of effort. And I know that this was written into the law with very good intentions of preventing governments from saying, oh, you're getting this state funding, let's reduce the amount of money that we give you. It hasn't worked that way. What's happened is we've had economic difficulty that's totally widespread, that's affected many entities, and they don't have a choice. They only have so much money, and they can't give the libraries as much as they would like. So it's like a double whammy if, in addition to that, we say, well, you can't have the state money either because you're getting less from your local. It's also just plain too important. Reading to children makes a huge difference in their lives, and I'm actually going to read to you. Read to your bunny. Reading together 20 minutes a day is the most important gift you can give your child. Read to your bunny often. It's 20 minutes of fun. It's 20 minutes of moonlight and 20 minutes of sun. 20 minutes brand new. Read to your bunny often. And your bunny will read to you. Jackson County Library has used the Ready to Read grant funds for many wonderful projects, and I've listed them and some of them in the written testimony. I won't take the time to read what I've written, but Read to Your Bunny project was one of the most successful in that it really did go out and reach parent groups who then started reading to their children and passing the word on to other parents. In our neighboring county of Josephine, where they're really hard up for library money, they are using their Ready to Read grant just to get children's books in the library. That's how essential the project is. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know if you're aware. This bill is on our Tuesday agenda. Members of the committee that don't know that. So you're not only very timely, but we will be sure that your material goes into the record. Officially, questions from the panel. You will, members of the committee, be hearing more about this specifically on Tuesday. So you couldn't be more timely. And again, we look very responsive.
You do.
Thanks for coming and reading to us. John Zupan. A realtor.
Chairwoman Berger and members of the committee, I welcome you to Medford. And also, you pronounce the name right. It's spelled Z-U-P-A-N, and my son always calls it Zupan, so he doesn't have to spell it, but that's great. I'm a resident of Medford, grown up in Southern Oregon here. I'm also the president of the Rogue Valley Association of Realtors, and I'm here to speak about Representative Buckley's House Bill 2520, which he brought forth on behalf of the city of Ashland. And this bill, of course, is to repeal the state's limit on transfer taxes, local communities being able to impose transfer taxes on the sale of real estate. And a little background on this, the transfer tax, which is really a sales tax on real estate, the main reason the city of Ashland, I think Portland, wants to impose this tax or be able to have this tax is for affordable housing, and nobody more than a realtor knows the problems we're having with affordable housing in the state of Oregon right now. But the problem with the transfer tax is, first of all, this is a community-wide problem. The community should be dealing with it as a whole. When a transfer tax hits a very small segment of the community, approximately 3% of the properties transfer per year, so we're limiting the tax to a very small amount of people. The other problem is the thing that's brought this problem forward is mainly a matter of supply and demand. I grew up in Ashland, born there, went through K through 12, graduated from SOU, 4 years of college there, moved to Medford in 74. I could not move sideways back to Ashland now if I sold my house. I think Ashland's probably first or second most expensive place in the state to live as far as housing goes. But a lot of it's been brought on by the government of Ashland. And for example, Representative Richardson's community of Central Point, Eagle Point here locally, these communities have embraced a program of annexing land, bringing in enough that they can have a very varied housing cost from high to low across the board. City of Ashland's put very high restrictions on their urban growth boundaries, very small, their annexations are very small, and as a result, what we have is a supply and demand problem. And now what they want to do is tax the people that own property to try and make property more affordable instead of actually looking at what the problem is. We as realtors, we would like to work with the city, like to work with the state to come up with ways to solve this problem. The problem, to get to the point, the problem we have with transfer tax, first of all, it's a regressive tax. And a tax is regressive when it costs more to the lower income people percentage to their income as it does to the higher income people. And it's been proven as people's income goes up, they pay a smaller percentage of their income proportionately on housing than they do with the lower income. So therefore, the tax is going to hit the lower income people harder. They're somewhat discriminatory as well. They're assessed against one type of an asset, real estate. They don't hit stocks, bonds, or the community as a whole. Again, you've got one segment of the community that's trying to solve the problem instead of the whole community. Households that move more frequently for whatever reason, they do not derive more benefits or they do not place additional burdens on the services they use, but yet, as a result, they're going to be taxed higher than the people that don't move. And this violates the principle of horizontal equity, which holds that people who are equal should pay similar taxes. Also, the narrow base of the transfer tax really, in the long run, won't solve the problem. In the late 1970s, early 1980s, real estate sales dropped by 50%, so it's a very volatile place to place the tax. Again, in the 1990s, real estate sales dropped by 20%. The problem with the sales tax is it has nothing to do with the profit. A person could actually sell their houses at a loss because they need to get out of it because of the illness, transfer, whatever the reason may be, and they're going to pay a tax when they sell, whether they made a profit on the house or not. Our position is we think that instead of putting this burden on a small portion of society, also it's going to impact especially first-time home buyers, maybe other home buyers in the market right now, because it's going to increase the closing costs at time of closing, which maybe take them right out of the market. We feel what we need to do is try and work as a whole community to solve the problem. One of our plans would be to maybe work with LCDC, come up with some type of fast-track annexation for low-cost housing, get the cities to cooperate, and on property that's brought in for low-cost housing, the cities could waive their system development fees and other costs, which in the city of Ashland can exceed $11,000 per house, waive these costs. Perhaps the people that are buying it would be limited to what type of profit they could take on these properties if they sell them in a very short period of time, making them last or keep them longer, or having to return part of their profit back. Representative Esquivel hit me with a plan the other day that I thought was just great, and you folks should probably talk to him. I'm not going to go in depth on it now, but it would be a plan that starts out with government, but it would actually end up in the private sector, and this thing would perpetuate itself forever, and it would really help solve the problem. And I think Representative Esquivel should bring that plan forward and take a look at it. We're not against, I mean, we understand the problem. It's a major problem, but we very much think that if you impose a transfer tax, that is not the solution. It's actually going to be a negative. It could actually force a detrimental economic impact on the state, hurt some people that are trying to get into the housing while you're supplementing others, and we just don't think it would really be good for the state. Thank you.
If you'd stay right there for just a moment, we're going to hold this hearing in abeyance while they change a tape over there so that the PEG access folks don't run out of tape. And then I'll entertain questions from the panel. Okay, I think we're back in business. Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions or comments? Representative Buckley, I think I need to give you first choice. I'm sorry to say we're not hearing this one Tuesday, Wednesday, but I can tell you that if it's heard, it will be heard in the Revenue Committee, and there are three members of the Revenue Committee in front of you now. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. John, without, I'm sure the Chair would not like me to enter in a long debate on this issue. Thank you for sharing your views on this. The bill proposed, do you know of any other industry in the state that has pushed through a prohibition for the cities of our state to not be able to consider rules and regulations concerning that industry?
No, I don't, sir, but by the same token, in essence, they are already taxing very heavily when you get into the system development fees and all the other taxes they're imposing, as well as property taxes, which hit that industry.
I
hope not. I'm not here to prepare to debate.
I'll just make a comment that I appreciate your suggestion that a community-wide solution be sought, and I believe that's what Ashland is referring to. The mayor of Talent has spoken to me as well. I think every city in our district, as well as the state, is looking for community solutions, and I would look forward to, no matter which way this bill ended up, whether it passed or not, to working with the other association, to work with Representative Esquivel and his idea, to working with on any and every idea possible to address this problem. It's extremely extreme concern to me that our teachers, our police, our firefighters can't leave in Ashland anymore, and I don't want to see that continue in our state and looking for solutions that we can finally address affordable housing. In my view, all quivers, all arrows belong in the quiver, and again, I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just to bring everyone up to date on this, I've had this idea and been working on this idea for a number of years, and I'm going to have it put in writing here in the next couple of weeks, and I'm going to disseminate that through the Senate and the House, because I think I have a way to be a self-perpetuating low-income housing approach, where we can take our assets, focus them, and make the monies self-perpetuating and build upon themselves. So it'll be and I've explained it to Representative Buckley before in the past, and I believe he picked right up on it. So there are a few details I have to iron out, but I will have something here in the next couple of weeks.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Specific interest. Connie Saldana. I didn't see it. Oh, there is a bill down there.
Hi. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak. I have three of my great legislators here in the room. I actually came just to listen today, but I realized that this is a perfect opportunity for me just to build your awareness. I'm not speaking to a particular bill. I work for Senior and Disability Services of the Rogue Valley Council of Governments. I'm not a state employee. I work for the Council of Governments. But I would like to speak on behalf of the people that work in our state branches and offer the services to the very most vulnerable people in our area. From two levels, both from the state and from the federal level, there's been a huge increase in the amount of paperwork required of our case managers. And from the state, it started, it's already complex just because the rules that govern our programs are very complex, but they had an additional increase as we tightened up on definitions of things, and I think part of it is to reduce costs by eliminating people from services due to eligibility differences. And what it means, and then from the Medicaid level, just recently we've started having requirements for our workers to document everything in so much detail, with the assumption that if the documentation isn't there, the client didn't deserve the service. So that means that the case managers are spending an increasingly high amount of their time on paperwork. And it's not that they don't have computers, they do, but they work with several programs which don't talk to each other, and it's just a great burden. The reason that it occurred to me to mention this to you today is that it's becoming an example of bad government. The people that come to our offices are getting less and less service, and yet they hear, you know, well, it's just it's frustrating for the clients, and it's also frustrating for workers. And I basically just wanted to make you aware of that. I don't know that anything is being proposed. I've talked about it in different forms with different of my legislators, but I just wanted to go on the record that it's becoming extreme. And we're having clients tell us that, and of course our case managers and eligibility workers.
Hi, Connie.
Hi.
And I believe that we had a conversation in my office, and Don was there, and I cannot remember if it was Medicare or Medicaid, that in order to administer the program, 80% of the time the worker that is administering the program is doing paperwork. Now think about that. We've made and layered ourselves into bureaucratic inefficiency. And that's a travesty. That means 20 cents on every dollar that comes in is being spent with the end user, what the intent of the original dollar was. And that, well, we need to fix it. So I'm with you on this.
Mm-hmm. And nobody is arguing the importance of accountability. But when everything is structured on distrust of government, that means that everybody that thinks someone might get a dollar too much of benefits, we need to create another rule so that person doesn't get the additional dollar. It's really self-defeating. And that's, I guess, my comment on that.
Thank you so much, Connie. I appreciate you bringing that forward, and again, I think there's a sincere desire to streamline the ETC process as well, every chance that we can. Representative Esquel and I are co-sponsoring a bill currently that I think you're aware of in terms of doing senior disabled evaluations. And part of it also what we're suggesting in our bill is that the people who receive services from senior and disabled services actually have a chance to comment on what's happening to them in terms of the service, the quality of the services, and suggestions that they have on how the money can be saved and how these services can be more efficient, hopefully allowing them more money to be available for other people that are in need to receive care. So we look forward to your comments on that. I appreciate you and the work you do.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Hey, everyone. Thank you for coming. Madam Chair, Connie, I appreciate you coming forward with this. If you have
specific suggestions, since you're working in this area, on what can be done to allow for the accountability and reduce the paperwork, that would be very helpful.
I'll ask the case managers and the eligibility workers. As part of it is just layers on layers on layers. Everybody getting worried there's also a change in philosophy. Our system has always been set up to evaluate the client and provide the most appropriate service to their level of disability. And now the system is being changed to more of the self-sufficiency model, which is you don't get anything you can't prove you deserve. So it's a backing into it for people that are going to be on the system for the rest of their lives, many of them, not all of them. And so there's a different philosophy that's running the whole mandate for paperwork. But thank you for your offer, and I will ask the people on the ground if they have suggestions. I'd be surprised if any clients have suggestions of how to cut their services to save money, but, you know, maybe they will. And we do actually have, and we place prominently in our offices an opportunity for the clients to comment on their services, and I'd say 80% of the comments I've seen are actually positive about the services they receive, but are grateful. But thank you again.
Connie, thanks for coming and speaking to this. I think this is an issue that we, as legislators, as all governments, struggle with, which is how much can we give freedom to go and do, and how much do we have to pull back for accountability's sake. And as dollars get scarce, as you well know, accountability becomes even more critical. And I think in your particular field, it's sort of a nightmare of extremes, federal, state, local, all have their own system, and the most disturbing words from my point of view were the programs that don't talk to each other, mm-hmm. because you're caught in the bottom trying to provide services and being asked different questions from different venues, and they should be talking up here, not down here where you're trying to do good work. And I appreciate your comments on this. I believe Representative Cameron is on the Health Committee, is he not? And he can directly take some of these comments and ideas down within, you know, your particular area, which I think is absolutely true, one of the most regulated, over-regulated, under-regulated, over-understood, complex parts of government, and I sure appreciate your good work and your willingness to support.
Thank you.
That's the end of the sign-up list I have before me. If anyone else cares to come forward, your name is all you need and your opinion. You, Rob, are you signing up? Yeah.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, since you're in Southern Oregon and since this is a unique opportunity, especially since several of you are on the Revenue Committee as well, the governor this session has proposed the legislation that Senator Metzger and I proposed last session regarding funding for state police. And as the former chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, regardless of whether it's that particular piece of legislation or carving out money for our local for state police, on a statewide basis, it is an important thing to Southern Oregon, especially, and many of the rural areas throughout the state. In the room tonight, we have Lieutenant Kurt Barthel. I think he was here more for security reasons than other things, but I think that the Southern Oregon delegation, I don't know if you've had an opportunity or any of you have had an opportunity to meet Lieutenant Barthel. He is in charge of the local district office here. I had the opportunity to serve with him when he was in charge of our Jackson County Narcotics Enforcement Team. He also served doing sex abuse cases in Jackson County, and you will not find a finer detective and administrator than Lieutenant Barthel, who is here this evening. I know that as he struggles to train new troopers, and as we struggle as a state and legislative body to fund the crime labs and fund officers. I think it's critically important, especially in Southern Oregon. They cover many of the areas, and in rural Oregon, that frankly other states, that other municipal agencies cannot cover. They're better trained. They have better equipment. They have better resources. And it's critical to make our economy and other things function down here, that we have a lot of safe areas. And Madam Chair, I know that you have been the key sponsor of many key legislation on methamphetamine. As Lieutenant Barthel would probably tell you, and many in Southern Oregon, he's probably been in more meth labs and other things than many officers that you have. But if we continue to downgrade the funding in state police, we're not going to continue to be able to recruit and retain people like Kurt Barthel and other people. I consider Kurt a personal friend and somebody who is, you know, who has dedicated himself to doing the right thing. But if we continue to freeze pay and do other things for state police, we're not going to have that high quality that we need. We've put a lot of things forward and basically paid a lot of lip service to the people in uniform in our state. I think it's critical this session that we really step forward. We weren't able to do that from timing issues and other things last session. But in order to do it, you know, and Madam Chair, you've brought the meth thing forward, and as a former drug prosecutor for 3 years here in Jackson County, I'm happy that some of that stuff is moving. I know it's a funding issue, but still we need to not only pay respect, but pay to play and continue to have these good investigators and people like that. So I wanted to take this opportunity to acknowledge Lieutenant Barthel, as well as the committee, and, you know, and I don't know if Representative Richardson or Representative Buckley or Representative Esquivel have had an opportunity to meet him, but he is a key resource in our community for fighting the meth problem, state police issues, and he knows what's going on the ground and is very well respected by everyone from the line staff on up.
Thank you, Lieutenant, for being here. I've had a chance to meet him before, and we do have a very sincere concern about funding for state police. Representative Escobar, you know?
Yes, just for everyone here that's in the Medford area, I did some research on this very issue, and in 1976, we had 36 troopers in Jackson County. 29 years later, today, we have 12. Population has gone up 60%. We just had a fatality this last summer, and I believe it was three or four people were killed up on Highway 140. We didn't have a state trooper on in Klamath or Jackson County at the time. The desk sergeant had to leave the desk to respond. To me, that's unacceptable. And I would hope that the legislatures today take the leadership in order to fund our state police properly. Because without the state police, your interstates, how many people do we see today with speed like crazy? Why? Between here and Salem, you're lucky to see one or two troopers. That's why. They just aren't there. And I was talking to the lieutenant before, and he was telling me the statistics on Grants Pass. There's 26 officers in 1976, and I believe you said there's five today. Is that correct? So just do the numbers. Population increase 60%, decrease almost two-thirds in the force. So we need, as an organization and as legislators, an organization, I mean state police need to work with us, but we need to fund this in a manner, and I know what you're thinking. I hate to see a police officer in my rearview mirror, too. But I'll tell you what, when I dial 911, I want to see one. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative.
There was one.
Representative Cameron drove us down here, and we noted one. And we all looked at our...
Was the ticket down there?
As
he found it.
I also want to comment on the math for... Rob Patrick is quite generous. I have one little meth bill that I proposed, but I will tell you that it has been a huge discussion within the building, there are a number of initiatives within the legislature targeting that 70, Representative Buckley says 70, I believe it, and the Judiciary Committee's, I spoke today with the Judiciary Committee Chair, are you on Judiciary? No. I spoke to the Judiciary Chair, Representative Krieger from the southern part of the state, and today about it, and he said that they are in the process, both in the Senate and the House, in taking those 70 separate bills and working them into a package of initiatives, getting the costs, relative merits, and putting them into a pretty comprehensive attack on a problem that, unfortunately, Oregon is clearly the worst shape in the nation, and it impacts every one of us, not just the officers, but every one of us in our homes as crime goes crazy, and the state is taking care of more and more children in families that are totally devastated by a drug that is far worse than I believe than we've seen before. So it's of great concern here, not just the law enforcement piece, but the whole devastating impact. And I will tell you that your legislature is very aware of it.
Just a comment, being on Health and Human Services, it's, I mean, probably 60-70% of the things we're hearing too, whether it's mental, state hospital, the children that you just referred to, it impacts such a huge part of our society and our economy. Well aware of that.
Without further comments, I have no. Please come forward if you'd care to speak to us. We're here, and we'll ask you to state your name and issue for the record.
How can we pass this opportunity? I'm Sue Dinsmore, and I live in Medford. I wanted to talk just briefly about two particular issues, very, very briefly. I've just been appointed to the Oregon Progress Board, and I wanted to compliment both the House and the Senate. I don't think the House has a member yet, is that correct? But, Kurt Schrader attended our meeting, we just met last week, and I think the thing that I can say from about now 20 years, I'll see, I'm not sure it's been that long, of working with the benchmarks is that they do set the trends, and they do prove issues where we have given resources, really made a focus, like say meth, you can really see the difference. And if you look at teen pregnancy, and I know you've all been working with them, but I think the point being that we as some of the new members on the board are interested in really helping you make the benchmarks help your budgeting process. And I think Kurt is talking about there's a dysfunctional, I mean, the benchmarks were created and they don't necessarily match, and we know that. But I guess just to offer my interest in helping you all use them. They are a tool. I think they're a very effective tool. And if we can do a better job of helping them help you do your budget, this session probably not. I mean, I think you're going to work with them the best you can. But as we go through the interim into the next session, it was our goal, and we had a very, I think, positive and healthy discussion with Senator Schrader about that. So that was just one thing I wanted to say something about. One thing, for example, in education, we are really seeing some impacts on the funding issues where the kids in the elementary schools are doing better, but as we're getting up into eighth grade, as we're losing some of the sports, arts, having larger classrooms, less aides, we're starting to see now an impact. The kids aren't doing as well. I mean, it proves. You can watch the men's march. You can tell what they're saying. The other thing I wanted to just offer a small comment on, I do work with a lot of the small communities, and, of course, Southern Oregon, Jackson County, Josephine County are made up of, I think, 20 small communities. And Burke Raymond and I completed last year a study on how Shady Cove, Gold Hill, and Rogue River make use of their public money, and how we make good use of all the different programs at the legislature. You often will create these programs, you never hear how they work. Quick response, maybe smart development, some of those programs. And so I would be happy to get you a copy of the report. It was quite insightful. Bruce Laird in Oregon, I'll see those, Oregon Community and Economic Development Department, sorry.
OECDD.
OECDD. he was quite fascinated with the results that we found, and I think in your general government committee, and I don't know how widely the report was distributed, Oregon Economic and Community Development paid Burke and I to do it. We only did the three Southern Oregon communities, but we found it was very interesting on the evaluated their tax base in relation to their use of block grants, in relation to their long-term sustainability, systems development charges, many of the things that that the small communities struggle with. You know, how can they afford a new water system, a new sewer system, some of those things. And so, anyway, if you'd like a copy of it, I'd be happy to get it to you. I think it might you might enjoy it. Yeah, I don't know where it went. I mean, we gave it to Bruce, and you know, so
Sue, this is not your responsibility. Kara Fisher just got
Kara.
Assignment.
I know, Kara.
We're sure that we get a copy, and other members of the body. Districts certainly touch on it, need to see it too, so we'll be sure.
All right. Thank you
very much. And thank you very much for your service on the Progress Board. Are there any questions?
Sue, I'm pretty new at this, and you mentioned the Oregon Progress Board, and then you talked about benchmarks and education. Can you just describe for us what those would be that you look at?
In about 1985, 86, I think the Progress Board was created, and it created Oregon Shines 1. Oregon Shines 2 was completed in 1990, I think, and we're in the process of developing Oregon Shines 3. And what that does, it looks at a series. We had 259 benchmarks in the beginning, and it was to set each year we would evaluate different things, teen pregnancy, for example. I wish I would have brought a document tonight. I didn't even think about it. It for example, tests in third grade how well the children are doing in math and reading, eighth grade math, how many people, for example, in Oregon have a college degree. If the numbers are, if we're doing better or worse, it trends, and it says, you know, we can continue to keep track of the numbers of all those different situations. The trouble was with 259 benchmarks, we couldn't get the data every year to show what the results were. And so they were somewhat ineffective. So we cut it down to 100 benchmarks. And what those are is they cover everything from economic development to environmental issues to education to health care. And many of them do reflect, again, like I said, how the funding goes. You can see, like in teen pregnancy in, say, late 90s, we put a lot of focus on teen pregnancy. In particular, I think in Astoria or someplace like that, I mean, we tried it to see what would happen. You could immediately see that the teen pregnancy went down when there were programs directed toward that community, there was money directed that direction. I mean, you could really see the difference. And so what we have now are 100 benchmarks that we, a report is due out, I think, in April for this particular year to show you how we're doing. And it's report every year. And then we do we give the grades. You've heard the F's and the C's and the D's, and people are they worry about the fact if they get a low grade. And that is to show how much there's been a positive or a negative effect in the previous year on how we're meeting the benchmarks. And they're all trends. They're trends. And the thing is, we try to, some of them we don't have enough data to give you how we're doing. And it has to come from all, we have to get consistent information from all 36 counties or whatever the, whoever's carries out the program to be able to give you an effective benchmark. But I think former Representative Pappage can probably talk about the fact that within the last session, I think the Oregon Progress Board became a part of DAS. And so with that requirement, then Department of Administrative Services. And the goal was that these trends then would be able to be used in your, or I guess your, somewhat obligated to use them in your budgeting process, so that again, as the funds are distributed, we're looking toward the outcomes and what the trends are and what the effect is. Does that make sense? April we'll have a report for this particular one. We're looking at the draft right now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sue, for your questions. Sue, thank you very much, and thank you for your service. Hi.
I'm David Sabia,
resident of Medford. Wait, sit down.
I'm sorry.
Got to get in the mic.
I'm David Sabia, resident of Medford, and thank everybody for being here tonight. This last election cycle, I know that Representative Esquivel, Representative Buckley, and Representative Richardson, really got an earful from the citizenry around here. And I congratulate all of them. A lot of folk is a perception. And so my comment and my question is to do with an accounting for all state agencies from top to bottom and all state programs. In Jackson and Josephine counties, there's a perception. It may be erroneous, but it's a popular perception among many people that there is redundancies, waste, and inefficiencies. And some people are just not willing to vote for any more taxes or to give any more revenue to the state. I know in the case of tonight, we heard from the library and we heard from the state police. You know, obviously, I mean, to most people, they probably think that that's where some of the money should go. And they wonder, what's happening? My question is there a mechanism for the legislature to do an accounting of all agencies to look for these things and find out if there is, in fact, some things that can be cut, redundancies, some things that where there's waste, some inefficiencies? Perhaps then maybe the citizenry would be a little more willing to say, okay, we're confident, and we'll cough up a little more money because we feel that it's well spent. So those are my comments, and I thank everybody.
And good comments, and appropriate comments they are. I'm gonna ask Representative Richardson to talk about the Ways and Means process, because he's the Ways and Means person here, which is an important legislative process. But you have hit on one of the difficulties that all of us struggle with all the time. One person's waste and redundancy is another person's favorite program, I can guarantee you, and we're going to hear from them no matter what. And what was the comment I always hear with regard to government? There are plenty of champions for the status quo. And it's very hard sometimes to move things, to make them be done differently. I would tell you that the recent downturn in the economy has focused a lot of energy and attention, not just in the electorate, but the electorate then gets the spotlight on those of us in the elected process. I think you'll never find any of us who are going to go forward and say, oh, I want to go to Salem and get a redundancy, an inefficiency, or more stupid programs up there. That is a reality. But to specifically your question, the kinds of things that we're doing, it's very fortunate that Representative Richardson is here, because he's in the Ways and Means, which is sort of the heart of how we budget. And I'd like for him to describe what we're doing differently and what we're doing differently.
Mr. Sevilla, I'm glad that you asked the question, because it's one that I think citizens all over the state are feeling about. And there's a tremendous disconnect between the citizens who pay the taxes and those that are so thoroughly involved in the programs that they spend the money. Because in the building, the question is always that I get, and I have about six groups a day that come, when I'm not in meetings, they're coming knocking on the door because I'm the chair of the subcommittee on Ways and Means over Human Services, which is about a $9.7 billion chunk of funds from our all funds budget. So it's a lot of money. There's hundreds of programs, and it is very, very difficult to do the thing that you're discussing, because every program has a constituency. They weren't started for no reason. They were started for a specific reason. And then once they're in place, there's a group of people that feel that, you know, that they're doing the right thing, and they are. There's great intentions, but there is a lot of redundancy, but it's never admitted. For instance, I'm over just looking at one area. There is a need to make sure that pregnant women and their babies get proper care and treatment, because if the baby's healthy, it'll affect their ability to learn and their success in the future. And if the mother is well nourished and is trained, then there's less likelihood of abuse and those kinds of things. And so we have Healthy Start, Fresh Start, First Start, early head start. I told the committee the other day that we're not going to have multiple start. Okay. There's WIC, there's a cocoon, there's relief nurseries, there's a program in DHS itself that I can't think of the name right now, but there's about 10 that I came up with that all have a focus on that general area, but they're all a little different because one may be helping the child become ready to learn, and the other is to help the child not be abused, and the other is to make sure that the child's properly nourished. And so I asked the question, wouldn't it be possible to expand it so that a child that is healthy is not getting abused and would be ready to learn, but every one of them has a unique focus. And so each one of them is very careful not to step on the toes of the others. The Healthy Start is like a sacred program, about $23 million budgeted for it. It is a voluntary program that focuses on first pregnancies and first births. And so, but since it's voluntary, not everybody who needs it, and those that may need it the most won't volunteer for the service because it means a worker comes in. It has the ability of benefiting less abuse, and abuse could be even verbal abuse. And if you look at the total number of births, it's like 44,000 a year. First births are like 18,000. It raises the, it benefits children that might be abused. Presently, if it wasn't for the program, they're like at 20 per thousand. With the program, it's down to 12 per thousand. And so if you have 18,000 and you have a benefit of 8 per thousand, you know, 8 times 18 is what, 164? It's 150. And so you have $23 million that are lowering the abuse, not beating up or murder, but that's a broad abuse, for 150 children. Now, of course, there's a lot of other benefits to the program, but as far as the benchmark on it, you know, what is it actually affecting, it's benefiting that you could measure 150 to 160 children. And I brought this up, and the response was, if we're helping one child, it's worth it. Well, yes, it is worth it to help that one child, but $23 million, and so here we are in a position of having to utilize the tax money in a way that, because every dollar that's used in this program is not used in another program, I'm just saying it's very, very difficult. What you're asking for is zero-based budgeting, where you go to each budget and you start from the ground up. But it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort because there's so many, you know, we're talking about $40 billion in all funds budgets, so it's very hard to do that. I suggested to our Ways and Means Committee just last week that as we go through these budgets, we start at each, we look at each program and we start with the question, if this program did not exist today, would we create it? It was like this quietness because, you know, that is a fundamental question, but that's not what goes on. In the building, this is not a business where you have 51% of the stock and you look at efficiencies and you say, okay, we have this much money, we're going to fund the top priorities and work our way down, and when we run out of money, that's the end of it. A budget has to be done, and it has to get through the House, through the Senate, and signed by a governor. And so ultimately, there's a lot of discussions about things that are important to different people because you have to have enough votes to get it all the way through. And we are looking at it in a different way in that we are prioritizing this time, which is, you know, we're using the benchmarks and performance measures, outcome-based budgeting, and we just this week turned in priorities, like the Department of Human Services, there are 73. So we've ranked it from the most important down to the least important, but they're all important, or they wouldn't be there, and they all have a constituency. And then we know how much money there's going to be available, $12.393 billion of tax and lottery money. That's the amount of money that can be divided among public safety, and, you know, which is incarceration, jails, prisons, police, laboratories, state police, all of these things, which are all very important, the courts, defense attorneys, because you can't, you know, prosecutors, all of this, it's all part of that, so it's very necessary. You have Health and Human Services, which is, you know, your medical plan, children, seniors, long-term, very important, and you have education, all very important, and all wants a substantial amount of that money, and there's not enough to go around. And so it's a very difficult challenge, and before we're done, we have to meet the constitutional requirement of a majority vote in each of the houses and the governor. But we are very aware of the need for outcome-based measurements, but it's still a political process. But we are working on it. It's a huge challenge. There are efficiencies that can be made, but they don't. You don't make these changes quickly.
Mr. Smear, that was a probably.
That?
Did you get all that?
I'm ready for my exam.
What I think we would like you to go home with is that we share this concern, and particularly as resources are scarce and needs are high, and everyone's priorities. And that's why it's important that you communicate with us, with your elected officials. Make sure, particularly, which priorities are yours are important, and pay attention. And we really appreciate you here and talking with us. What's your budget?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good comment. David, thank you. I'd like to put this one other spin on this, too. And I don't think that we've done a very good job as a state of telling people in Jackson, Josephine County about Connie Saldana and the work that she does and the people she works with, the senior and disabled services. If you go into a home of a senior who's being served, and they get to stay in their home, and it's because of the services people like Connie expect. For every dollar of waste, I can show you hundreds of dollars that are going to save someone's life or keep them working well. The state does a tremendous amount of good work as well, which does not get a lot of attention. I'm on the Trade and Economic Development Committee, and there's a program called WorkSource Oregon. You know, I read a lot, and even before I came to the office, I tried to study as much as I could. I'd never heard of WorkSource Oregon. I don't know if you have either, but it's a program that's been in place that actually is a kind of, it's almost if you look at like a match service between potential workers and employers, that if you're an employer and you need some employees and they're not trained, or you don't have enough trained employees for your job, WorkSource Oregon matches you with a pool of employees that can get trained through a community college to fit into your business. It's a great service. Over 70,000 people got jobs last year through WorkSource Oregon. You don't hear about it. That's some expenditures of our state money that actually are having a positive effect. I respect Representative Richardson's task that he has to go through. I've sat on this committee twice, and I'm in awe of what he has to try to decipher with his budget because of the kind of weaving of funding sources. But I'm sure that we all share that desire to make sure that every dollar that does come out gets spent well, has a really positive impact. And there are programs that have positive impact, and we need to do a better job talking about those so people feel good. You know, I pay my taxes too. When I sign that check, I want to feel good when I send that check, and I want you to feel good too.
Yes, David, thank you for being here this evening. I think with me, it'll always be, I'll never be satisfied with the vision. I have yet to see an organization, whether it be private or government, that has over 100 employees that can't take 5 or 10% off their overhead and still maintain their services. And I've made that challenge to CEOs of corporations, and they admitted, yes, we can do that. That's in the private sector. So I do understand, but I want you to understand as well, when we get up there, it's kind of like you take a little pick and you stick it in the ground, there's a little hole there. And the more you keep picking away at it, you see that hole is big down there. And these are the things that we built, and these are the things that we have to approach. And it's a monumental job in order to achieve that. It's like sculpturing, though. You don't go up and hit it with a hammer. You take a little chip here and a little chip there, and maybe after 10, 12 sessions, which I won't be around, we'll achieve something. But as long as we continue to strive toward efficiency, as long as we continue to strive for non-overlapping of services, then I think if we have that frame of mind, then we'll make success.
This is where you come and talk, and it looks like we're doing all the talking. But I think you've hit sort of the central sort of question, you know, that kind of philosophically what people are grappling with. I mean, you look to the state police and ask them about efficiencies, find some more efficiencies, and I think they would laugh at you or cry. So this at sometimes, I mean, I agree with what Representative Esquivel was saying, but another way to look at this is, I don't know if you've ever gone out to dinner with, let's say, eight people, and the check comes, and some people filter out, and if you're the last one there, somehow it doesn't add up. Because everyone wanted to eat, but not everyone wanted to pay for it. I want state police, but I don't necessarily want to pay for it. And it's understandable. There, you want to find efficiencies, but also any private corporation that wants to succeed understands they have to make investments, perhaps in research and development and training. And trying to find that balance is really the challenge. And I think what Representative Richardson was talking about in the, you know, the zero-based budgeting is what we're attempting. And I just wanted to throw in one more element that we're really not talking about, and to the extent I think we should. There's a big thick book called the Tax Expenditure Report. And tax expenditures, some people might call tax loopholes or tax breaks. And it's about there are about 350 some odd tax breaks, many of which I'm sure everyone in this room would say those make sense. They, you know, they're smart investments, or there should be a break here. But some of those that maybe a lobbyist really pushed for or somehow got through, and maybe some of us are pushing to take a look at those and say, you know what? What about accountability for those types of expenditures? Because if you take money from here, then you know, it's not, you don't have the money for the state police. So that's another area where it's $9 billion. So if you have an RV, I don't want to pick on RV owners, but if you have an RV, that's considered a second home, and you can deduct your interest on your loan because that's considered a second home. So some people would say, boy, that's not such a good or wise investment. Other people would say, yes, it is. So I'm glad you mentioned perception, because one of the things that I've learned in the couple of months here, this is an enormously complex endeavor and set of processes, and it's the easiest thing in the world is to, for example, sit on talk radio and say, oh, there's so much waste here. And I would love for some of these folks to go and talk to the state police or talk to some other agencies. But we are doing, as you know, Mr. Allen was here, and this is, I would say, the overarching goal of this legislature is looking for efficiencies. But it's a complicated and difficult process.
Glad to see that you talked to us. No, but you hit the core of the matter, and we should bring forward.
I'd like to say thank you to everybody very much, and I'm glad I'm at this little table and not at your table. Thank you.
We've seen no one else wanting to come forward and talk to us. I will take the chair's prerogative to close by saying that this, some of the differences between past legislatures and the way we've run things and the way we're trying to respond to some of the things we're hearing out there, is one of the things is visible before you. We meet up in Salem. I'm a Salem legislator, and when I get outside of Salem and someone says, oh, those people in Salem in the legislature, I know, it's me. I'm from Salem and I'm in the legislature. It's a double hit. I know what you mean when you say Salem in that disparaging remark, in that disparaging way, and I don't take offense. We're a citizen democracy, and we need to come out and talk to you, and you need to talk to us. In order to maintain what we value about being Americans. And that's why we're down here. This legislature is making a substantial effort to get out, even during session, and not just during the election season, to talk to folks like you. I applaud your willingness to come out and talk to us, all of you, and please keep the dialogue going. And with that, I am going to officially close this session of the House General Government Committee. Thank you.